This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's something almost more chilling than the crime itself in many cases. What is it? A lot of times it's what happens after. The hours that follow, the blood, the screaming, the panic, when everything should stop, but somehow it doesn't. When someone who's just taken a life doesn't run, doesn't break down, doesn't even look shaken, they just go back to life. That's what sticks with people about Brian Koberger. Not just the crime, the horror that unfolded inside of that King Road house, but what came after. The footage. The white Hyundai Elantra caught on surveillance in the early hours, coasting through the quiet Moscow streets. The same car, prosecutors say, seen circling the neighborhood again and again, headlights off, like a ghost rehearsing its own escape. And then hours later, daylight. Koberger walking through a Costco, calm, alone, browsing, as if he hadn't just driven away from one of the most brutal crime scenes in Idaho history. No running, no panic, no visible guilt. Just a man moving through aisles. And that's the part that hits you in the gut, because it's not new. We're going to go through this. It goes far beyond Koberger. We've seen that kind of calm before. And I got to say, if you're going, you sound a little bit stuffed up today. You're right, I am. Allergies are horrific today. So I'm going to try and get through this story the best I can. I do apologize if I pause for a moment to take a sip of water or if I have to blow my nose. I'm going to do my best not to, though. All right. John List. Who's that? He murdered his entire family one by one in their New Jersey mansion in 1971. His wife, his mother, and his three children shot. Yeah. It was a horrible scene. Then he sat down and made himself a sandwich. He ate lunch in the same house where their bodies were still cooling. He told police later he was hungry when asked, "What? Why?" After that, he turned on a religious station, wrote a letter to his pastor, canceled the mail, and left. Well, it's a good thing he took care of his needs, his issues, his affairs. He didn't hide in panic. He planned. He tidied up. He methodically shut down the world around him like a man closing a business for the weekend. And then he vanished for 18 years. When they finally found him living under a new name in Colorado, he looked like the picture of suburban stability. Job, church, neighbors who said he was polite, quiet, and ordinary. That word, ordinary, keeps coming up in cases like these. That's what people always say. He seems so normal. He was just like anyone else. Now that's the trick. That's the performance. Or is it a performance? Or is it just as scary as it seems that they can go and perform such horrible deeds and walk away, pick up a McChicken off the dollar menu, and go on their way? Go watch the game. Go grocery shopping. Go do the normal things you and I do every single day, but couldn't possibly fathom doing if we had just gone through that sort of a trauma. Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, he perfected it. He was a church president, a compliance officer, a father. He took the lives of 10 people, sometimes entire families. And then went right back to being the guy who reminded neighbors to mow their lawns in Park City, Kansas. It's a guy you'd run into at the grocery store over at the Leakers, maybe at the salad bar where they have that delicious broccoli salad, which they actually do at the very Leakers that Dennis Rader used to frequent. I used to eat it in that parking lot all the time. I worked right down the road from it. It was my lunch. I didn't realize the story or how it was all connected until many a years later. In April of 1985, he was a Boy Scout, or he was at a Boy Scout camp with his son. In the middle of the night, he told the troops he wasn't feeling well, slipped away, drove to his neighbor's house, and strangled her to death. Then he cleaned up, hid the body, drove back to camp, and flipped pancakes for the kids the next morning. Dad, the next time you hear the phrase pillar of the community, remember that image. A man cooking breakfast for children hours after killing. And the thing is, he didn't feel like he was pretending. He compartmentalized it. The killer, the father, the community volunteer, all separate files in the same cabinet. That's how this kind of mind works. It's not panic after violence. It's a return to baseline. I mean, think of it. If you look at a filing cabinet, now, those of us that remember filing cabinets when we actually use paper and things, I think we all know what a filing cabinet is. You don't know what's in those files. On the outside, that filing cabinet can look like any other filing cabinet. It may even look like a cool filing cabinet. Sometimes you got some neat designed ones like, oh, that's really aesthetically pleasing. That's a cool one. But you don't know what's in the files until you start looking. And sometimes you may be very, very disturbed by what you find in that otherwise normal-looking filing cabinet. That's how you got to think of these people. Chris Watts and his pregnant wife, Shannon, he took her out, strangled her in the early morning hours of August 13th, 2018. Then he smothered his two little girls, Bella and Celeste. And at 5:15 a.m., he went to work. He drove to his job at an oil site, the same site where he buried Shannon in a shallow grave and dropped his daughter's bodies into oil tanks. He texted coworkers, took calls, and ate lunch. By the afternoon, when friends started calling because Shannon had missed an appointment, he acted surprised. That night, he gave interviews on this front porch, hands folded, telling reporters how much he missed them. The next day, he begged for their safe return. It's not that he didn't know what he'd done. It's that he thought he could manage the optics of it. Play the part of a concerned husband long enough to get away with it. That's what calm looks like when it's weaponized. Stephen McDaniel murdered his classmate Lauren Giddings in Macon, Georgia, strangling her. Dumped her remains in trash bins outside of their apartment complex. After breaking her into pieces. And then when people noticed that she hadn't been seen for a few days, he joined the search. He even printed flyers. He called her phone. He gave interviews. There's a clip. You might have seen it. Where he's standing outside talking to a news reporter. His voice is steady, a little nervous, but not panicked. He's describing how worried everyone is, how they've been looking for her. Then mid-interview, the reporter tells him that a body's just been found. His face freezes and his eyes widen. And for a split second, the mask cracks. It's one of the most haunting moments ever caught on local news. The realization hitting him in real time that the story he'd been performing just ended and that the real one was about to begin. Up until that exact moment, he was convincing. He was the worried friend, the helpful neighbor, the kind of guy you'd never expect. Which is exactly why it worked. Colonel Russell Williams was one of Canada's most respected military officers, a base commander, a pilot trusted with flying the prime minister. And he was also a predator. He broke into homes, stole women's underwear, took photographs of himself wearing them. Then he escalated, kidnapping, assaulting, and unaliving. After taking the life of Corporate Marine France Camot, one of his own subordinates, he attended a charity fundraiser on base, the kind where officers get fake arrested to raise money. There's a photo of him that day, handcuffed, grinning, 2 days after taking a life. He was pretending to be arrested for laughs and charity. It's not irony. That, my friends, is pathology. He lived a double life so complete that even his closest colleagues had no idea they were saluting a murderer. He'd kill at night, then iron his uniform and meet with politicians by morning. The same precision that made him a trusted officer made him a terrifying predator. That's what this calmness really is. It's control, a desire to manage every narrative, every expression, every trace. And you don't need to do that using extreme measures or being crazy seeming to the public. Then there's Tyler Hardley, 17 years old, July 16th of 2011. He killed his parents with a hammer because they wouldn't let him throw a party. You know, like you do. He then hid their bodies, cleaned up the blood, and by that night, there it was, the party. 60 kids showed up, beer pong, music, even noise complaints. He used his parents' debit card to buy alcohol and snacks. At one point during the night, he pulled his best friend aside and said, "I killed my parents." The friend didn't believe him until Tyler opened the door to the master bedroom. There they were, covered in towels, hidden beneath piles of stuff, and his friend took a selfie with them before leaving to call police. The photo became infamous, a grinning teenager killer posing with a friend who had just seen the truth. And everyone else in that house kept drinking, laughing, partying, oblivious to what was actually in that bedroom. Again, not a metaphor for denial. If that's not, I don't know what is. Susan Smith rolled her car into a lake with her two little boys inside. Then she called police and said they'd been carjacked by a stranger. She went on national television. She cried. She begged the fictional man to bring my babies home. The country watched heartbroken, a mother pleading for her children, except it was all a lie. She'd already taken their lives. For 9 days, she played the role of victim, giving interviews, holding vigils, hugging supporters. When investigators finally confronted her with the inconsistencies in her story, she confessed. The world turned on her overnight. The image of that weeping mother, crocodile tears under TV lights, became a cultural shorthand for deception. That's what makes these cases so powerful. It's not just the crime, it's the act after the act. The way they wear empathy like a costume. And Ian Huntley in England, 2002. Two 10-year-old girls, Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, vanished after visiting his home. He was a school caretaker, friendly, trustworthy, dating a teacher's assistant. He took both of their lives. Then he joined the search. He gave interviews to the press, told reporters how helpful he'd been, how he'd likely been the last to see them alive. He stood on camera describing their smiles, pretending to care, all while knowing exactly where their bodies were. Kept it up for nearly 2 weeks. That calmness, that composure. Wasn't guilt, it was pride. He was controlling the narrative. He liked being part of the story. When police finally found evidence linking him to their death, that confidence evaporated. But until that point, he looked like every other well-meaning neighbor volunteering to help. And that's the horror of it. Sometimes the killer is the guy handing out the flyers. When you start to see the pattern, you realize this calm after chaos isn't coincidence. It's not just evil trying to hide. It's evil trying to appear ordinary. There's something in the human brain, even in the most monstrous ones, that craves equilibrium. They can destroy, mutilate, devastate, and then feel compelled to restore order, at least on the surface. To make the world look right again, even if they've made it irreparably wrong. John List turned on the radio to Christian hymns after taking out his family. Dennis Rader made breakfast for kids. Chris Watts went to work. Brian Koberger went to Costco. It's all the same psychological rhythm. The act, the cleanup, the calm. Think about that for a second. When we picture these people, we imagine mania, frenzy, guilt. But real evil? Real evil's quiet. It's calculated. Doesn't twitch. It smiles for cameras. It holds down jobs. It hosts barbecues. That's what makes it so hard to see. Because it looks like stability. When you look back at that footage of Koberger walking through Costco, hands in his pockets, holding that bottle of water, expression neutral. You see him in the grocery store, looking around, like, what's for dinner? It hits a nerve, because it looks like everyone else. The only difference is he already knew. He knew what he'd done, and he knew no one around him did. That's the dark allure of normal for these people. It's camouflage. It's power. It's the ability to blend in while the rest of the world scrambles for answers and you have them. That's why they're doing this. That's why this takes place. And that's why the calm isn't just eerie. It's dangerous. We like to think we'd notice something, a crack in the voice, a look in the eye, but the truth is most of us wouldn't. We're trained to see guilt as panic. We expect shaking hands, heavy breathing, visible remorse. We don't expect someone to be eating lunch next to a body or cooking breakfast after strangling a neighbor. You're telling a reporter they're just so worried when they already know the ending. We see it time and time again, though. We mistake composure for innocence. We see calm, and we assume conscience. But calm doesn't mean conscience. It can just as easily mean control. And that's what ties them all together, from Koberger to Rader to List to Smith. They weren't just trying to hide the crime. They were maintaining the performance of normal. Every smile, every errand, every interview, every step back into the world was a test, a rehearsal of their ability to stay unseen, to see if they could still pass as human after crossing that line. Most of them did, for a while. And that's the part that sticks with you long after the trials, the documentaries, the prison interviews fade away. Not the violence itself, but the quiet that followed it, the calm after catastrophe. The idea that some people don't look like killers. They look like us. They look calmer. If you think you know what evil looks like, think again, because sometimes it doesn't rage. It shops. It smiles. It goes to work. It sleeps well. Evil doesn't always come crashing through the door. Sometimes it just walks past you in an aisle, pushing the cart eyes forward like nothing ever happened. Have fun at the grocery store today. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube, if that's where you're at. If not, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there. Love to get your thoughts on this and the many stories that we follow for you right here. I'm going to go take some more allergy medicine. Thanks for joining us. Looking forward to that feedback. Please hit subscribe. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.